This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. The Quality Community Council recently held a series of discussions about the persistence of poverty. We now bring you the third of this series as a public service presentation from St. Paul's Episcopal Church on January 31st. Thanks to CPN volunteer Sean McCord for recording the event.
Quality Community Council welcomes you to the University of the Poor. The general topic of this series is the persistence of poverty. My name is Neil Halverson Taylor. I'm one of the organizers of the series, and I'll be the moderator for this for tonight's conversation. Before we begin, I'd like to take time to thank our partners who made this series possible: the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, the UVA Department of Religious Studies, Legal Aid Justice Center, Public Housing Association of Residents, and the Virginia Organizing Project. And I'd like to thank St. Paul's Memorial Episcopal Church for their hospitality in hosting us for this, the third conversation. I'd like to give a round of applause to the church for that. I'm told also that the students who are organizing on the grounds for the Living Wage campaign have a resolution that will be going around the church tonight, and they have asked you to support it by signing the resolution. A week ago, across the street at UVA Chapel, we gathered for Conversation 1, The Face of Poverty. We talked about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that each person on this globe has the right to work, food, clothing, medical care, housing, education. We discussed the need to change policies and to confront practices that make people poor and that keep people poor. And we saw in the face of 9-year-old Juwan the face, the real face of poverty. Last Thursday night, we gathered at West Haven Community Center for a second conversation, the poverty of redevelopment. We talked about the lack of affordable housing in Charlottesville, the bureaucratic mazes those who need such housing have to go through even to get just on a waiting list, and how the poor are often pathologized by the rest of the society, in the words of Dr. Cory Walker. Now is the time to rethink in radical ways how redevelopment in this city is done. Whose agenda is it? Who benefits? Who makes the decisions? And we challenged ourselves on that night to be agents of change in this city, to recognize and exercise our democratic power. Tonight, as we gather for Conversation 3, I must note that 2.5 hours north of here, in a hall about the size of this sanctuary, the President of the United States will make his State of the Union address. His speech will not be a conversation. There will not be time for dialogue. And I doubt there will be many, if any, poor folk in the Senate chambers. In this series, we call our speakers conversation leaders. They will prime tonight's conversation. They will spark it. And I suspect they will describe the state of the union in very different terms than the ones used by our president. In your program, you have a fuller biography of each of the speakers. But I'd like to introduce them rather quickly, noting the variety of perspectives they offer for tonight's topic, the poverty of underemployment. And I'm sorry to say that one of our speakers, Doreen, or conversation leaders, Doreen Niblins, is not here tonight. Professor Claudrina Harold grew up in a labor union household. Her research interests are black nationalism and black working class politics. Teresa Araby lives in the West Haven community and has recently added a tool belt to her wardrobe as a senior trades utility worker. Meredith Richards is, among other things, a local newspaper columnist who writes about real issues. Jan Cornell will talk your ear off about jobs and justice. And Joe Sakos is a sharp and effective and effective community organizer. Please help me in welcoming our conversation leaders. Quadrina Harold.
It is a pleasure to be with you today to talk about the problem of poverty and the problem of how labor can deal with the problem of poverty. For much of the day, I've been reflecting on a life and legacy of Coretta Scott King. Of course, I'm pretty sure most of you know that she passed early this morning. And there's a way in which when we talk about Coretta Scott King, we talk about her as the wife of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But it's very important to understand that she was an activist in her own right. When Dr. King was assassinated, it was very critical for Coretta Scott King to not only continue her involvement in the civil rights movement, but most importantly for our discussion today, to continue her struggle in the Poor People's Campaign. Of course, the Poor People's Campaign is not something that we talk about when we talk about Dr. King. In fact, there's a way in which they systematically exclude that part of Dr. King's legacy from media images of Dr. King. So there are very few discussions about Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign 2 Mondays ago. So I'm going to start my discussion with Dr. King. 6 years ago, the late news anchor Peter Jennings hosted a moving special entitled Memphis Dreams, Searching for the Promised Land, which captured the last months of Dr. King's life and the last months of his spiritual and political journey in this wilderness many of us call America. Few scenes in the special were more gripping than King's speech at a local Baptist church in Memphis, Tennessee. Questioning the political and moral foundations of this country's very flawed sense of democracy, the Baptist minister from Atlanta, Georgia, ordered the federal government to meet its obligations and responsibilities to the poor. He wrote, and listen to the language, or he said, "It is criminal," he asserted, "to have people working on a full-time basis and full-time jobs, getting part-time income," end quote. Following up on these comments much later, at a later date, King pointed out the economic dimensions of American citizenship. He wrote, "If a man does not have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty nor the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists." Of course, we all know for Dr. King, life was about much more than just existing. And life for us is about much more than simply existing. Towards the end of his brilliant political life, King rallied behind the poor in their fight for a living income. He didn't say living wage. He said living income, fair housing, tenant rights, and workplace democracy. This was how King understood freedom. Of course, left unexplored in our discussions of King is his deep commitment and his deep compassion for the beleaguered poor. I want to give you a brief quote by Dr. King, and it talks about the relationship between poverty. It talks about the relationship between poverty, war, and imperialism. "A nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and will have to use its military might to protect them. All these problems are tied together. What I am saying today is that we must go from this convention and say, America, you must be born again," end quote. So today, I want to talk about the role of labor in the rebirth of this particular nation. The role of labor in the rebirth of the nation, the role of labor in the rebirth of this world, and the role of labor in the rebirth of humanity. Labor has to play a critical role. because we live indeed in critical times. And we need a vision for these trying times. Over the past 4 years, poverty has risen and engulfed more Americans. 12.7% of all Americans live in poverty. The rate for African Americans is 24.7%. The rate for Latinos is 21.9%. And let's be clear, most of our nation's impoverished citizens are children. More than 35% of America's children live in poverty. This is morally reprehensible, quite simply. But when we talk about how we pathologize the poor, let me say this. A significant percentage of America's poor go to work every day. Because more than 11% of Americans are receiving minimum wage. Minimum wage is $5.15 an hour. Conservatives will tell you, well, it's just teenagers. That's a lie. More than 75% of American workers who receive minimum wage are adults. And many of them are supporting families. And many of them are struggling to find fair housing and medical benefits. This is inexcusable. The minimum wage has not risen since 1997. One study said if minimum wage would have risen as the rate of the average CEO, minimum wage would be $23 per hour. Of course, we know better. Further complicating matters for the American worker is this systematic assault on American workers and American unions. And I say assault because that's the only way I can understand what happened in New York with the transit strike. That's the only way I can understand what happened with the Delphi workers. That's the only way that I can understand what's happening with NWA. It's a systematic assault on American workers, and the American labor movement needs a vision. This is why the American labor movement needs a vision. Because workers need wages and benefits that make it possible to live stable lives. They need laws to ensure that the conditions of their employment are safe. And in places where unions exist, we must fight diligently against the imposition of a two-tier system. That's what the New York fight was all about, the imposition of a two-tier system. TransAfrica President Bill Fletcher makes the argument that the two-tier system, what it does is it creates resentment between older workers and younger workers. But I think it does something much more harmful. I think it results in erasing historical memory. By 2015, according to my very flawed mathematical skills, Some baby boomers will be out of the labor movement. And these are people with historical memory of what happened in the 1930s and the 1940s and the battles that their mothers and their fathers engaged in. The point that I'm trying to make is this. You will have a group of workers that don't have any idea or have low expectations of wages because there's no other working class group by which they can compare their circumstance. So it's an issue not only of increasing resentment, but also erasing historical and political memory. And this is something that the labor movement cannot allow to happen. We just can't. Statistics show us that we need labor unions. Workers who are in organized unions earn more. In fact, workers who are in states that don't have and non-right-to-work states earn more. So the question is not about if we need unions. It's very clear that we need unions, but I will argue that we need much more. We also need labor councils, citywide labor councils. More importantly, we need a social movement composed of class-conscious Americans. We have to build social networks. We have to build communication networks. We got to stop too preaching to the choir. We need to re-energize the movement. And the one way that you re-energize the movement is we have to begin connecting to groups and organizations that are not a part of this movement right now. We have to draw from the lessons, too, I think, of the civil rights movement. When you think about the speed in which Rosa Parks and Edie Nixon, who was a member of what? The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. When you look at the speed in which they organized African Americans, it was because they had social networks. It was because Edie Nixon was already connected to porters, the sleeping car porters. It was because Rosa Parks was connected to the NAACP. It was because Joanne Robinson was connected to student activists at Alabama State University. So they were ready to roll on December 1st. Ready to roll. And it is my hope that American labor unions and American workers are also ready to roll. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Teresa Araby. I come from Louisa, Virginia. I had went to New Orleans for a while and had four sons. I came home. I didn't finish school, so I decided to go get my GED, and I went to K-Tech and got apprentice to get a degree that is multi-trade. Now I work at Schultz. I did work at Schultzville Redevelopment Housing, working on the apartments, and I switched over to UVA in the maintenance of the housing division for the students. In the meantime, when I started, I was paying $254 rent for an apartment in West Haven. Now, with my degree and at UVA, I just got told yesterday that if I stayed at income-based rent, I would be paying $1,495 for a five-bedroom apartment. Or I could choose to pay flat rent for the same apartment is $1,188. My income did increase over 6 years, but so did my rent. So did raising the four boys, their expenses. And I look at myself as like, my income went up, my rent went up, so did the expenses of the kids, but how can I keep putting food on the table? Gas goes up and insurance is going up. As a worker, I love my job, but I need more pay. We need more education. We need some breaks. You know, I've busted my behind for 6 years with four kids, missing all their events at night to go to school at K-Tech, and I've got bigger bills. Even though the income has gotten a little bit bigger, but it's not enough. It's like a puzzle. You have this big picture, and one day you're going to get there. And as you build up your ladder to get to that picture, there's somebody who has a huge boulder that they're sitting on top of your head and saying, you're not getting up there. Because the more you work, the bigger everything gets. Gas, I remember gas being 69 and 79 cents a gallon. It's what? 229, 239, and 249. When I first got my vehicle, my van, it was $45 to fill it up. I don't even fill it up anymore because it's almost $75 to fill up a tank of gas. And the only thing I do is go from West Haven to UVA and back. And once a week, I go to Louisa to check on my dad to make sure he's all right. And I'm out of gas before payday. And that's every 2 weeks. So I got to put $75 in my pocket and pray no kid gets sick. Because I can't afford gas and medicine or gas and food or a field trip that they come up with at the last minute. You have to tell them no. I don't want to tell my kids no anymore. The living wage needs to come up. Minimum wage needs to come up. We need more money. We need better education for our kids so my four boys don't have to go through what I went through. I can't afford to put them through UVA. That would be like the world coming to the end if I could afford to put them into UVA, because it's not a reality. I can't do it. One is 17. He's telling me he wants to go work at a Nissan plant in Jackson, right outside Jackson, Mississippi. And I'm like, where are you going to live? How can I put you there? He says, well, eventually I'll be in California. I'm like, well, we got to get you first to Jackson, Mississippi. You know, he's like, you can do it, Mom. You've done everything else. And I'm like, wait a minute. How can I get there? So I have to research. I have to find. I didn't think I would get my GED, but I did. And I got my journeyman's card. And I didn't think I'd get to UVA, but that was my big goal. I was going to get to UVA, and I made it. But now I want to buy a home. I can't buy a home because I got bad credit, because I can't pay all the bills. So where do we go? We need to teach our kids, our grandkids, so they can teach theirs about budgeting. Budgeting needs to be learned in an early age, not when, okay, here's time to pay the rent, but I'm 3 days late. We need to understand it a little bit more better. And by doing that, we need to teach our kids, our grandkids. We need money to come up for us, for all of us. I mean, how are we going to get anywhere? Gas needs to go down. Food prices need to go down. Because it was one box of hamburger helper at night. Now it's six boxes of hamburger night with four kids. And I'm like, they're $2 a box. So, I mean, I don't know where to start. But I think we all need to figure out somewhere. One person can't do it all. A single mom can't do it by herself. And neither can a family of four kids and a husband can do it by themselves. But there's other people out here who are struggling more than I am. And I really pray that we can break the system, not budget-wise, but the system itself needs to change. We need to come up with a better system. It's easy to put the numbers on paper, but have you lived that paperwork? Have you really lived on $8,000 a year, raising four kids and a husband? And then go to, say, $25,000 or $28,000 or $30,000 and try to raise those same four kids and a husband. But now the rent's not $254, it's now $1,495. There's a big difference. But let's all think about how we as individuals can change the system and try to make it better for us, all of us. Because one day I know I'm going to be 65. I'm supposed to retire at 70. I don't think I'll make it to 70. Social Security's not going to be there, so I can't save money for retirement. No college, you know, all those goody things. So we need to figure out how to fix the system. And I don't think Bush is the answer. I really don't, because he doesn't live in West Haven or down the street at Prospect. Or Garrett Square, First Street, Sixth Street, Mickey Madison, and Riverside, or Ninth Street. So they're not going to fix it. But as us together, as a group, we all can fix it. But we're going to have to work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. That was an inspiring story. I agree with you. Everything you said about wages in particular and our system. Karen Waters asked me if I would review some basics about our local job market. I really worked on that today. I can tell you that I talked to Karen about some of the information I had uncovered. It's so dry and so boring and uninteresting. I did come with charts and tables, and if you have any questions about what the growth sectors of our industry are going to be or our economy are going to be, what occupations are in decline, and something about the pay scales for each one. I'll be happy to answer that, those questions, because I do have that information. But I'm actually going to read something that Teresa has inspired me to read from two of my recent columns from the Charlottesville Tribune. One is called From War on Poverty to War on the Poor, and the other is called What is a Living Wage? These were inspired by an address that was given, a commencement address that was given at William and Mary this summer by our former presidential candidate and Senator John Edwards. It reminded me of another speech by President Lyndon Johnson, delivered to my generation of graduates over 40 years ago, that focused my generation on a problem that plagues America, a problem that is yet to be solved. It saps our national strength and harms generations of children. It persists, yet it has a changing face. It's the problem of poverty in America. President Lyndon Johnson in 1964 declared an unconditional war on poverty, and he entreated my generation to not rest until this war is won. 40 years later, Edwards called on today's graduates to put poverty back on the national agenda. Johnson's arsenal of programs in his war on poverty included Head Start, food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid, Job Corps, federal college loans, work study, community action agencies, and the American Service Corps, all designed to give people a hand up rather than a hand out through job training, education, and job opportunity. The harvest of jobs from his administration reduced the poverty rate from 22% in 1959 to 11% in 1973. Today, over 36, actually that was when I wrote this over the summer, the latest figures, 37 million Americans live below the federal poverty line, most of them in families from one or with income from one or more full-time jobs. These are the working poor. For millions of Americans, work and poverty go hand in hand. Today's poor are working full-time but are unable to provide the basic necessities for their families. Yet there is no national agenda to help them, no president calling for war on poverty or Congress raising the minimum wage. No guarantees of health care or child care for working parents. Instead, we have a Congress that has declared war on the poor by passing a federal budget that shrinks or shuts down anti-poverty programs and deepens the federal deficit to the point that Social Security and Medicare will eventually lose their vitality. We've just scratched the surface of our understanding of poverty in America. Even the statistics grossly underreport the numbers of poor. The Federal Poverty Index, devised in the mid-1960s, takes the cost of a minimum healthy food budget and multiplies it by 3 on the assumption that food expenditures represent about a third of a family budget. But a national project supported by the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Family Fund, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and the Normal Foundation paints a truer picture. And in my second article, What is a Living Wage?, I go into this study more carefully. If you recall, 5 years ago, the Charlottesville City Council wrote a budget that for the first time guaranteed an $8 minimum wage to all city employees. A couple years later, the school board followed suit. And at the same time, demonstrators from the Virginia Organizing Project, the Labor Action Group at UVA, and many of you in this room were picketing the Marriott courtyard, and faculty and student activists at the university were picketing the University of Virginia, demanding an $8 living wage for their employees. And I believe that public institutions should lead by example in reforming the inequities and social injustices that exist in our society. And the city has made great strides. Nevertheless, it is appalling just how far the living wage is from the actual cost of self-sufficiency in American households, and just how far we have to go before we achieve these goals. In the study in which I referred to earlier, there was a survey. It was done by local groups all over the country. Virginia Organizing Project participated in the survey for Charlottesville and Albemarle County. It surveyed the cost of everything from owning and operating a car, including insurance, taxes, registration, gas, and maintenance, to purchasing basic food, no takeouts or fast foods, to rental costs, childcare, health care, taxes, and other basic needs, not including clothes. The study, which can be found online at www.6strategies.org, reports the cost of self-sufficiency in every state, city, and county in the nation. For a Charlottesville family in 2002, the year of the study, the cost of self-sufficiency far exceeded what $8 would provide. For example, one adult with an infant and preschooler would have to earn $16.90 an hour, or $35,695 annually, to cover basic needs. Add a second adult, and each adult must earn $9.91, or an annual household income of $41,862, to make ends meet. A needed income of $21.67 per hour, or $45,765 per year, tops the scale for one adult with an infant, preschooler, and school-aged child. During the same year, 2002, the federal poverty line was calculated to be $15,000 for a family of one adult, one preschooler, and one school-aged child. It doesn't take a UVA professor to calculate the discrepancy between the federally defined poverty standard used to calibrate the living wage and the stark day-to-day reality of poverty. For many families in Charlottesville, poverty is any income less than $35,000 or $45,000. 2 years before this study was conducted, the U.S. Census recorded 773 Charlottesville families with children under 18, that's 19.2% of families in Charlottesville, living below the federal poverty line. Given what we know now about actual cost of basic needs, how many Charlottesville families would be classified as being poor if we recalibrated this number to match reality? The answer is that there are many more working poor than we've been willing to believe. We will not win the war on poverty until we put poverty back on the national agenda and address low wages for America's working families. $8 an hour, or even 10, is not a living wage.
Hi, I'm Jan Cornell from the UVA Staff Union. I had a really hard time with this speech. I called Neil. I said, I don't know what to say. And I told him a little bit about myself, and he said, well, talk about yourself. So I did. I think we've heard the statistics, and we all know how bad poverty is. I mean, I can't stand up here and tell you anything that you don't know. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself, how I came to be here, and just let you know. As a single mother in the early 1970s, that was before many people could even comprehend what a single mother was, I was plunged into poverty. My ex-husband abandoned my year-old son and I, with no food, no money, no gas, in the middle of Long Island. Long story short, obviously we survived. I worked usually 2 minimum wage jobs at a time. Childcare was very inexpensive back then. And sometimes did weekend work to make it. We lived in a HUD apartment, and although I worked, we were still eligible for food stamps and medical care, such as it was. The ER was our medical care. Eventually, I took a telemarketing job, which paid well and offered commissions. Things were looking up. My son was growing up, and I was even collecting child support of $80 a month. In 1983, I moved to Fluvanna County. It took me 1 year to find a job because I had no phone, no gas, and living 15 miles from the city. It was very difficult. Once again, my son and I were on food stamps and on ADC this time. Things were so bad, my son moved back to Northern Virginia and with his godparents because I could not take care of him. He was 11 years old then. I finally found a job which paid about $3.75 an hour or so. I remember I brought home $96 a week. In 1989, I began working at UVA. My starting salary was $14,000 a year. And I think that was probably poverty wages back then. I'm not sure. My point is, I understand what poverty is. I've lived it here and in other places. And I've always worked. One job, two jobs, sometimes three jobs. The thing that I noticed in this area is poverty seems to be very well hidden. Lovely city, wealthy university, big hospital. One would assume the area's largest employer would take good care of their employees. But we know that UVA is run on the backs of their employees, especially starting in July when the two-tier workforce begins. Except for highly paid administrators, professors, and managers, UVA doesn't pay all that well, and their benefits are eroding yearly. As we all know, the cost of living here has skyrocketed, especially housing. Many, many employees work two jobs so they can raise their families. This is unacceptable. There is no reason that a housekeeper, a secretary, a groundsman, anybody should have to do these jobs for 30 years. Absolutely not acceptable. Why isn't there job training, a career track, for the employees so they can get better paying jobs? Why isn't this happening? It's because nobody's pressured UVA to make it happen. Why can't employees get a free college degree at UVA? They do it at other colleges all over the country. It's not like UVA isn't rich enough to offer this huge benefit to its workers. If it wasn't for the local activists in this community standing up, speaking up, making folks aware, having forums like this, no one would ever know there's a problem in our community. But what is the solution? I can't stand here and say I have one. There are many, many things to do, a living wage, a minimum wage, education, skills training, literacy training, unionizing the UVA workforce. Some of it's already being done here. But what I want to say to all of you is I want to be part of the solution, and so does the staff union. As the other speaker said, labor unions are our future, even in a right to work for less state, even where we have no collective bargaining. I believe that organizing is truly the only way for workers to rise up. Thank you.
There's a special person in the audience tonight. And she didn't come here for this, but I'd like to acknowledge her. For 107 straight weeks, various people stood outside the courtyard by Marriott, right down here on West Main Street, to try to keep the torch burning that we need better wages. And for 107 weeks, with the exception of the times that she was out visiting her children, someone faithfully showed up, whether it was snowing or raining or in the hot sun. And tonight, I'd like to acknowledge Jane Foster for her role in doing that. just a side little footnote, it was a great time because on one side of the street would have Jane, who would give the people new to the area kind of a historical perspective of, we were out here fighting around race and now we're out here fighting about wages. And then we'd send them on the other side of the street and they'd talk to the younger generation about how this living wage campaign ties to globalization. So it was a fun time. Not too long ago, one of my daughters went to the orthodontist, and you go through the drill and they check you out and then they give you this piece of paper to give to your parents that says how much it's going to cost. And right here it says total fee for orthodontist treatment is $4,630. So I took out my little calculator and I thought, wow, if I was making $5.15 an hour, I would have to work 899 hours so my daughter could get braces, so that in her future, she wouldn't worry about gum disease and other problems that might come down the line. And then I took my calculator again and I thought, wow, if I'm working 40 hours a week, that's 112 days of work. That's 22 and a half weeks that I'm going to have to work to pay this one bill. So if I'm working full time at $5.15 an hour, I start work on January 1st, and I can finish about June 10th to pay one bill. It's obscene. We can get trapped in the question of what exactly is a living wage. We can talk about the federal poverty level. We can talk about it's 25% of our housing costs should equal our wages, or now it's 30%, and then they said 35%, now we're talking about 40%. We can talk about a living wage being the square root of 122. I'm not going to get into that tonight. I think that we have to stick to the moral argument, especially when we're here in a church setting. At the Virginia Organizing Project, we try to keep it simple. No person working full-time should live in poverty. No person working full-time should live in poverty. So I'd like to read something to you, and interestingly enough, the book is titled A Living Wage. The great majority of fair-minded persons believe, indeed, that labor does not get its full share of the wealth that it helps to create. But they are not agreed as to the precise measure of that ideal share. Upon one principle of partial justice, unprejudiced men are, however, in substantial agreement. They hold that wages should be sufficiently high to enable the laborer to live in a manner consistent with the dignity of a human being. John Ryan wrote this in 1906, 100 years ago, and we're still not there. I think we need to dispel the myth of Charlottesville that everybody's doing just fine, because that's just not true. And the good news is the problem is not out there. It's right in front of our faces. It sits right in front of us. And the other is the solution is also right in front of us. We need to get John Casteen, president of UVA, and Leonard Sandridge, vice president of UVA, and other employers in this area to stop the immoral act of paying obscene wages. We also need to acknowledge that much of the problem in Charlottesville is in the pews. Every Saturday and Sunday, there are people who are coming to houses of worship who could solve a big part of the poverty problem in Charlottesville. But we let them hide behind, she's a good Christian, or he's a strong person of faith. And yet we fail to challenge them to live their lives consistently with their spiritual beliefs. And I'll go back to number one. John Casteen, Leonard Sandridge, and other employers in this area need to stop the immoral act of paying obscene wages. So I have a question for you. You know, I'm not a young person in terms of this new technology, and I, you know, I didn't grow up with video games, and I'm not quite sure of this, but I have a question for you. Do we really need to spend $6.9 million to have a high-tech video system in the John Paul Jones Arena so that people who contribute at least $500,000 to get a front row seat will get a good show? Do we really need to do that and not pay people who are clean in John Paul Jones Arena enough that they can have video games for their own kids? Recently, I had the opportunity to have lunch with a group of workers at Emory and Henry College, which is in Southwest Virginia. And it was a wonderful potluck meal, and I was just asking them, you know, what's your life like? And one gentleman raises his hand, and he said, well, I work 40 hours a week here at Emory and Henry College. And I really believe in the mission of the school. I mean, it's helping young people learn and really make their lives different. He said, but you know, it bothers me that every 2 weeks when I get my paycheck, I turn it over and I endorse it to the health insurance company. And I'm working full time just to pay health insurance. And I said, well, if you don't mind me asking, like, how do you pay for food and housing and clothes and other things you need? He said, oh, that's where I work another full-time job. What does 80 hours a week working every week do to somebody? And so I think that we also have to factor in, it's not just about money and paying bills, but it's what John Ryan was talking about, the dignity and the respect and how people feel of what they're doing. We took the president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, Al Broaddus, on a tour. And our whole concept was, Al, I think your life and the places you travel are a whole lot different than what I see every day. And we took him to a textile plant in Martinsville. And we didn't know anybody. We just walked in, met the manager. He gave us a tour, and it happened to be lunchtime. And we went in the canteen, and we weren't really prepared for this because, you know, there's a bunch of vending machines, and we're all trying to find some change so we can get this poor guy something to eat because he had been traveling with us all day. And he sat down with a group of workers, and this was completely unrehearsed. We didn't know anybody. He plops down at the table, and he says, I'm with the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, which probably didn't mean a whole lot to them other than they heard bank. And the woman said, well, Mr. Broaddus, you do the arithmetic. I make $6 an hour. I work 40 hours a week. That's $240 that I make every week. You take out my taxes. You take out my Social Security. You take out the money I'm paying for child care. You take out the money I'm spending for transportation. What am I supposed to live on? And, of course, he didn't have an answer to that question. And I think that we need to start forcing ourselves to say, that's got to change because we have to be able to answer that question in a real different way. One other thought I want to share with you is that, you know, we always kind of hold it out. What's over there? And poverty is about somebody else. And this whole business of poverty is something of a convenience when really it's not. In Charlottesville, we got to be really careful because it is in everyone's interest. Or else we're going to trap ourselves. We want the grass cut in the parks. We want people available to help paint your house, to do your plumbing, to do repairs, to fix our cars, whatever. Well, if the price of housing keeps going up, and we push low-wage workers further out, and the price of gas goes up, if wages don't move, well, how are they going to afford to be able to come to Charlottesville to do the very things we need them to do? If you're paying somebody $5.15 an hour to clean your office building at night, the arithmetic's just not there to make it go. So it's in all of our interest to try to figure this out. I want to conclude with leaving you with two levels. The first forum, someone got up and said, well, but if just individuals change, we also need to change some of these systems. And I think that's absolutely right. And so here's a wish list. For one, it seems that we should pay a whole lot more attention to where we shop and what we do with our money. You know, it's a pretty simple habit. You say to the cashier at wherever you're shopping, do you make at least $10 an hour or $9 or $11, whatever number you want to make, whatever you feel comfortable asking? And they say, no, I don't do that. Well, then take 2 minutes and go over to the manager and say, this is immoral. And we would appreciate it if you would change. A second thing that we can do is that we work for employers, whether it's for-profit, public, nonprofits, that we can raise that question too. Do we treat everyone with dignity and respect and make sure they get paid? And the third goes back to an earlier point, is when we are in the pews, we have to challenge the people we worship with to put their spiritual beliefs and their actions together to make it work. On a systematic level, I mean, there's minimum wage laws before the Virginia General Assembly right now. There's minimum wage proposals before the United States Senate. We need to talk to Rob Bell, Delegate Rob Bell in Albemarle County. We need to talk to Rob Bell. We need to talk to Rob Bell. We need to talk to Rob Bell every single day. Maybe Rob Schilling can help us with that one. The other is that his email address is real simple to remember. It's jtc@virginia.edu. That's John T. Castine, jtc@virginia.edu. And if you don't do anything else, please send him an email, because if UVA would change their policies around contract workers and raise the level of wages for their direct employees, it would make a huge difference in our community. And the last thing is to check with the school board, the city council, the county governments, other school boards in the area, and any place that has public money, including a whole long list of nonprofits, and encourage them, as Meredith said, to be leaders and try to raise those wages. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you, all of you, for speaking. Our conversation leaders now are open to comments or questions from the floor. If you have one, please speak. Questions or comments do you bring to the floor tonight?
I have a question for Joe.
Okay.
The Chamber of Commerce is the problem with the minimum wage. They lobby heavy every year. Every year it dies in subcommittee, like this year. Why doesn't anybody ever go after the Chamber? And you know, and they say the same old stuff. Well, you know, we're going to have to let employees go, and it's going to be bad for the businesses. Same old rhetoric every year. Has anybody ever gone after the Chamber? I know they're rich and they got lobbyists. And what do we do with them?
I don't have any answers. I have a good question. Anybody out here have any ideas?
Thank you.
Anybody else have some ideas? Thanks.
I think the economics, the plain economics of raising wages really works to the benefit of local businesses. There's something called the multiplier effect, and I know you've heard of it. Basically, as I understand it, for every dollar you increase a wage, it multiplies itself four times into $4 out in the economy. It's the way our economy works. So it seems to me a compelling argument for the business community, and that means the Chamber of Commerce, is that higher wages translate into bigger profits for everybody. It supports local businesses in particular. So I think that's one of the things they need to hear from us.
That's the reason that Henry Ford, I think he doubled his employees' wages. It went up to $10. Anyway, he said, then they'll all be able to afford to buy Fords. And it worked that way. It was wonderful. I don't know why they've forgotten it.
I wanted to talk about two things. I think in terms of the chamber, they're business people and they understand numbers. And I think the important thing there is for them to understand the costs of poverty. And so we'll have to take up an educational effort. But we had another speaker on our panel that was going to talk to the issue of the difficulty that felons have achieving employment. And she couldn't be here tonight, so I just wanted to put that on our agenda, that we have many, many people in our community who have made mistakes in their lives. They pay their debt to society, and then when they come out of prison, there are very few employers, including the university, that will hire felons, and it's a real problem. And so I'm interested in knowing what folks think about that issue.
If we think about this for a second, if someone's only making $5.15 an hour, there's just no way that the numbers work. Because you got to remember, in Virginia, when you're a wage earner, you're paying Social Security and you're paying income tax. So that $5.15 shrunk even before you get your paycheck. Virginia, if you're on the low end of the wage earning, you're paying 10.5% of your income for local and state taxes. If you're on the higher end, you're only paying 8% of your income in local and state taxes. So it's a lopsided system. If you're making $5.15, they're taking money out of Social Security, you're taking money out for taxes, you don't have a whole lot left, which means if you're just trying to survive, you're going to get some other things. Maybe subsidized housing, maybe food stamps, maybe free lunch program, other social services that we could keep listing. Well, who's paying for that? We're all paying for that. So part of it is, I think, to reframe this and say, we're not just about raising minimum wage, we're about reducing corporate welfare. Because what we're basically doing is subsidizing these employers to do that. I remember being in Withful, and folks there are really trying to struggle. How does this rural economy survive? And one business person got up and he said, well, you know, I'm here to make money. So, well, I'm not trying to get you to run out of business, but why is it that we allow some employers to either mismanage their business or run risky businesses at the expense of the workers? And they say, we can't afford to pay higher wages. Well, that doesn't play out in the studies that are done. We're back to Rob Bell, right? We challenged Rob Bell in a public meeting to show us one study that says that raising the minimum wage really hurts the employer. Well, we're still waiting. That was about 2 months ago. So part of it is really connecting, I think, to say we're not just about raising wages, we're about reducing corporate welfare. And the other, and besides dealing with spirituality of some of the employers, I think the other thing is that those of us who want to see a change can't take the easy route. I mean, the person who's clogging up raising the minimum wage in the Virginia Senate is Senator John Chichester from Fredericksburg. He's president of the Senate, chair of the Senate Finance Committee. And when we ask other senators, like, who's the roadblock, they say, John Chichester. And we say, yeah, we know that, but who else? John Chichester. And they just keep repeating John Chichester. Well, that's what we need to do. Anybody here know anybody in Fredericksburg? Get his constituents, put a little pressure on. That's what we need. That's the rock that's stopping the flow. The other is, I think, that we also take the easy route by not going to the Chamber of Commerce and trying to engage them. Like, what are you doing here? Do you understand that, if, you know, we're taking it out of one pocket and putting it in the other and taking it out of here? Because somebody's got to pay for people to survive. Because as a society, we've decided that's important, but that's got to work somewhere. So I think that, that part of it is that we all have hard work to do, and we have to get on with it.
In terms of organizing and sort of effective ways to implementing change, I guess I'm going to go towards you, if you're head of the staff union at the University of Virginia. How do you plan on doing that, I guess, if you're a union organizer? My question is, how almost abrasive are your techniques? If you really find that John Castine is the problem, well, do you organize the people that you work with, go in front of his house and kick it there? A lot of other labor groups do things like that. They are more radical. And granted, I'm a university student, you could say that I'm closed-minded because I go here, but I haven't seen it. And I think the important part of union organizing is the ability to actually see picketing and put it in your face and put the problem in your face.
John Castine, I am not one of his favorite people. He doesn't care for me very much, him or Leonard. I'm in their face all the time. Actually, we just had a rally in December in front of Madison Hall for the Dina Bowers incident. We've had several pickets in front of the hospital. What I'm finding here at UVA is the employees are very afraid. Oh, very afraid. They're afraid that if they join a union, they're going to be fired, which is ridiculous. They're afraid that somehow Leonard Sandridge is going to see that they're getting their dues payroll deducted from their paychecks and they're going to be fired. That he's going to see them out on a picket line and all of a sudden they're going to be fired. So I have to overcome all of that. Plus, since we don't have collective bargaining here for state workers, it's very, very difficult to persuade people to join a union because they don't know what we can do. Well, we can do a lot, but it's hard when people are apathetic. I mean, we have a good membership, and if it's something like raising money or giving time to a sick person, they're there. But when it comes to getting out in the streets, I rely heavily on the community, and y'all always back me up. This project is a 10-year project. But we need members. We cannot have any power, any voice with three members. I mean, John Gassin's going, oh, yeah, we're real afraid of you, you know. So there's so many issues with UVA. We could be out in the streets every day, but a picket or a rally takes a lot of organizing. People are working. They can't just say, oh, I'm going to picket now, my employer. So, but you're right. I mean, when the Communications Workers of America came here, they're like, man, we've got 12,000 members here. hasn't worked out that well, but I don't know, but you're right. Union organizing in a right-to-work state with no collective bargaining, no strike rights is very difficult.
Are there some students from the Living Wage campaign here tonight? Can you just stand up and talk maybe a little bit about your strategy coming up? Thank you.
not seeing all the service, is that right?
Yeah, I class during the rally. I class during that December rally that she mentioned, so I couldn't see it. Now we don't need to do it.
That's one key for us to be taking that step of engagement in, is to make sure everyone understands that this is something that they can be part of. There are a whole lot of people who can go to and say,
from the movement days, and also one who's attended all three of these meetings, I've come away with a fantastic inspiration and deep despair. I mean, you know, Claudrina was talking a little bit about, and I used to be in the history department. One of the reasons I'm sorry I've retired is that we can't be teaching side by side. The whole King message of the last 3 years has been blotted out of our collective memory. He said we had to change the architecture of American society. And by that he meant that capitalism, racism, and militarism were all bound together. And you can't really, you know all those things, but what happened? All that's been blotted out. Another thing, the Living Wage campaign, I'm really inspired to see the students doing that. But we organized students year after year in 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67. It wasn't until they marched down the lawn. It wasn't until they had fantastic direct action that President Shannon said, oh, well, okay. It'll be okay to recruit black students. We'll seek a black faculty. You can have a black studies program. It wasn't until direct action came that people come from the olden days. They think, well, what we did was the only way to bring about change. But it is true that the end of that reform period that Claudrina was talking about, King said, we've got to have a revolution. And Lyndon Johnson said, oh, no, we're not going to have that. And we've had this fantastic reaction ever since. Now, I'm just talking about how meeting all these wonderful people. I heard you the other night.
Thank you.
Down at West Haven. You made me cry. And we got Tim. I don't know where Tim is. With no legs walking around. Where's Tim? Where, Tim, were you here? Stand up. You're a hero of mine. So, having been in university and teacher for 40 years, I learned how weak the power of reason is. People just don't change when you talk to them. So I just end up by saying, Joe, everything you say is right, and Meredith says it's right. Oh, everything. Organize the workers, do everything you can, talk to the people. When you're in a church, and I don't go to church, but then they say, you turn and say hello or greetings. Say, what have you done today? But all of those things are important, every single one of them. But we're not going to have real change until it's done at a national level, until we've energized somebody to care about this. Maybe John Edwards, is a fine person. But it's a huge thing, and I just end up by saying, let's each of us do what the hell ever we can. But keep your eye on the prize.
The opinions expressed in the preceding presentation are not necessarily those of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network or its parent company, Wordcast Productions. To find out how CPN can record your event, please call us at 434-566-1217 or drop us an email at info@seavillepodcast.com. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network.